The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, I came this morning prepared to give a talk. However, my preference would be not to give a talk. My preference is to hear from you, to see if there's any questions. Questions that you have about the practice or things, concerns that you have that you'd like to raise, and then I can try to respond best I can and have some discussion. So I don't have to follow my preferences, but perhaps we could open it up and see if there's something that's needs to be asked or wants to be asked. Someone wants to entertain my preference. And if we have a long period of silence, then maybe I'll give a talk. Yes, please.
So I'm just interested in how you think about this issue or use the practice to deal with this issue. It's one that I struggle with sometimes. So, you know, Buddhism encourages us to be generous and... Well, I don't know if they use language like unselfish, but it seems like there's a lot of ideas to that effect. And then at the same time, it seems like sometimes it's unskillful if you're doing things for others, not really out of a direct generosity, but because like you're afraid they won't like you or you're addicted to their approval or things like that. Mm-hmm. And I find that a really hard line to distinguish, and I think a lot of people do. And I'm just interested if you have thoughts on that from the point of view of Buddhist practice.
So you're saying sometimes it's possible to... So let's put aside Buddhism for now.
Yeah. When is it sort of skillful generosity to help another person? When is it, this is really not skillful... You know, therapists have all sorts of words, enmeshment, yeah. People pleasing, etc. But when is it? I'm doing this because I'm sort of afraid or addicted to people's approval or don't want them not to like me or something, rather than out of some genuine generosity. Kind of, how do you draw the line between those two things? Mm-hmm. Because one seems to say no, serve yourself, and the other seems to say no, serve the other person. But I think sometimes one is right and sometimes the other's right. Somewhat depending on the motivation, maybe. I don't know if that's clear.
I think it's a great question.
Or not.
I'm a little bit trying to find my way in the different way you talked about it. If the question is there is a difference between, well, first, since you did kind of evoke Buddhism at first, my understanding of the teachings of the Buddha, there's no obligation to be generous. So, there's no obligation. However, it can be strategic to be generous, and it could also be a natural kind of, almost natural kind of movement of the heart to be generous in certain circumstances. And so when you feel inspired to be generous, it brings you joy and seems like a right thing to do, and hopefully then there's wisdom involved. In understanding, is this a suitable time to be generous? Is it the right person, the right situation, and all that? Because if you only give based on I want to give, it might not be even helpful for the person we're giving to. So we have to have some wisdom involved as well. So if it's a spontaneous upwelling of the heart to be generous, there should be wisdom there. If it's strategic, which is some people would cringe. Using the word strategic next to generosity. But if it's strategic, means it has some purpose. Well, one of the purposes that the Buddha championed is when it supports and develops the cultivation of your own good qualities, your own mind. So generosity can be a practice that we do for our own sake. It releases the clinging of the mind, the conceit, the selfishness that might be there. It cultivates some really good qualities of good connections to other people, a generous attitude towards other people, maybe compassion, caring, friendship. A lot of things can come with it. And it's fine to be generous if one feels one's benefiting from it in those ways. That's not necessarily selfish. And then there's a kind of generosity where it's meant to be an exchange, where it's not really exactly generous, but it's really playing an exchange for something in return. And so it could be someone's praise, it could be someone's approval, it could be codependency is a common word in order to get people enmeshed in your kind of thing. And so if you pay attention to that, you probably see that that's not helpful. It's not. It brings a lot of suffering, it perpetuates unuseful behaviors. And so how do you know the difference between these different kinds? That's your question. And so I think it requires a certain degree of mindful reflection and attention to what's happening. It takes a lot of mindfulness in oneself to really understand what's motivating oneself. So in this practice of ours, we emphasize looking at your motivation. And that motivation is really a key. And don't just settle for the first motivation you see there. Motivation to be generous, you know. But for what reason are you being generous? And then you say, oh, just because they need help. And, you know, but what reason do you want to help them? Oh, I want their approval. So you kind of have to keep asking for a while and kind of see deeper and deeper. And then also you might become aware of the different emotions and feelings that come into play when you want to be generous, or just before you want to be generous. For example, there might be fear. That before the impulse to be generous, there's some fear. And that fear says, oh, this is interesting. Maybe I need to look at this more carefully and careful I don't act from my fear, because of my fear and being generous. Or it could be greedy. It could be that there's a desire to have something first, and then there's occurrence, oh, if I'm generous, then I'll get that. So a lot of self-understanding is needed. And then also you need to look a little bit at what goes on interpersonally. What are the consequences of generosity, of giving? And sometimes you can feel, see, if you pay attention, oh, if I give, there's an expectation in return. If I give, then a certain dynamic, social dynamic, interpersonal dynamic is set into place, which I actually would rather not see happen. Or part of me wants to see happen, but actually if I really am honest about this and look at it, then, you know, I don't know if this is really helpful. So I don't know, is that answering your question, or you want to ask again, or you want to be more specific about a concern?
No, that's helpful, thanks.
Yes?
You spoke about next Sunday the nuns are coming. I'm curious about the role of monasticism in spiritual practice, specifically in our tradition. This, I'm just trying to make sense of the sense of that they are different and need to be treated special than us, and that kind of separation between the monastics and the lay people. Uh-huh. And just the role of that, and I don't know. Could you address that?
It's a great question. I don't know if I have a good answer, because I'm actually still reflecting and considering this myself, this whole issue. And one of the reasons why I wanted to open it for questions today is that there's circulating around globally these days a certain amount of controversy around what's going on with nuns and nuns' ordination. And maybe some of you have heard about the controversy, and so I wanted to see if anyone felt that it was really important to bring it up. And because of this, you didn't bring it up, maybe you don't know the controversy, but then, you know, I'm also reflecting on kind of the same thing. So I don't know how to answer your question very, very well, but I can offer a reply that comes from the understanding I'm coming to right now, my own understanding. When I look at Buddhism, history of Buddhism, the Buddhist teachings and all that. I think it's useful to think of monastic life as a strategic way of having a strong practice. being able to devote oneself 100% of the time, or most of the time, to practice in a way that's hard to do, not impossible by any means, but harder to do if you have a job, a mortgage, kids, parents to take care of, and all the different things that has to go on. Certainly, remember there was a story of, it was a famous Sufi teacher here in America. Maybe not Pirbalad Khan, but one of the Khans. Jack Kornfield went to see him one day, and in that conversation, the Sufi teacher said, "You know, if you took most of the great, I studied in the Himalayas. I went in India and all these different places. Studied with great masters there. And if you went to the Himalayas and took all these great spiritual masters with huge attainments and all that, and transplanted them to suburban America with two kids, a mortgage, a job, a lot of them would have a really hard time." So that's a very interesting statement to make, and that has all kinds of implications, perhaps, that could be talked about. But one understanding of the monastic life is that it optimizes the conditions from which a person can engage in practice most of the time. So like for me, I'm very grateful for my monastic time, to be able to kind of immerse myself in a monastic schedule with a lot of meditation, to be around other people who that's what their primary purpose in life is, to engage in spiritual practice, and to do it, basically 24 hours a day for years on end, to me was a real blessing. I benefited tremendously from that. I know that some monastics very clearly understand or feel that they have it easy, in terms of being able to practice all the time. They set up conditions that make it easier and more joyful and more, to practice than, if you're always busy, engaged in so many different things. So I see the primary value, the purpose of monasticism is strategic, as having to be supportive and helpful. Some people also feel a very strong affinity to the lifestyle that is, and the maybe for personal reasons, to affinity to that lifestyle, to that way of being, and other people don't. It's a personal thing. When I was 17 and 18, I had a strong attraction to go and join a Catholic monastery, not because I was Catholic, and not because I believed in God. As an atheist, I just thought it was one of the great lifestyle. This contemplative lifestyle and the silence and the quiet, and I just thought, what a great way to spend a life. I just felt an affinity to that kind of way of being. So some people feel an affinity to that kind of lifestyle that that monasticism is. And so it's more than just a strategic way of practicing, but it's also a lifestyle that seems very nice. When I lived at Dasahara, which is a Zen monastery, my feeling was it was the perfect lifestyle. I just thought it was great. What could you do? And so I was very happy, I think, in living that way. In ancient India, there were no IMCs. There were no community meditation centers. There were no retreat centers that people can go and like Spirit Rock can go to and meditate for a weekend or a week or 3 months or whatever. And it was very hard, I think, for lay people in ancient India, and still much of the world, I believe, who have to work and do all the things that they do, to be able to even afford to take the time off to go on retreat and be able to practice intensely. I'm sure it's true for a lot of you as well. And maybe some of you would like to be more go on retreat sometimes, but it's hard to find the money. Even taking the time off, for many people, it means lost income. And so it's a big deal to be able to do it. And so in ancient times, there was even less set up to allow lay people to practice in a strong way. And so for people who really wanted to kind of, were really on fire and really felt a strong necessity to go and practice, the institution of monasticism or renunciation was a way of really optimizing that, making that possible in a deeper way. It's kind of like going off to college, It's very hard to get a college degree when you're kind of living a busy life and, kids and jobs and everything. You can do it. It's possible, but usually it takes a lot longer. You have to, you do night classes and whatever. And so, you know, college students is a certain kind of, you know, renunciation. and the opposite. And the, you know, it's, it optimizes the conditions for studying. And so, you know, at 18 they go off perhaps and they have these optimal conditions that they don't use. some of them. But, and so, in India, they had this institution where it optimizes the conditions to allow some people to go do something. I don't think, I never had a sense in reading the teachings of the Buddha that anybody was obligated to become monastic, or that that was the only way to practice. In the time of the Buddha, there were plenty of lay people who did practice, and who had attainments, attained experience of realization, of enlightened awakening. And so, maybe not as many as the monastics, but there certainly were. There were lay people who were teachers at the time of the Buddha. And so, you know, I don't get a sense of this very sharp divide spiritually, but there was a very sharp divide in terms of roles. And so monastics have a different role than most lay people. It's very rare to have lay Buddhist teachers. Here in the West, we have a lot of them. It's a kind of a new phenomenon. In the most of history of Buddhism, people who had the time to practice and to study and be prepared to be teachers were monastics. So monasticism was also a very important, had a very important social role as being the preservers of the tradition, as, in a way that probably wouldn't have been preserved if it hadn't been for the monastic kind of institutions holding it. But now, as modern society has changed so much, some of the role that monasticism had in the old days, they don't have a monopoly on it. It's not the only place to do that. It's now it's possible to study Buddhism as a lay person. You can go to university and study Buddhism, get a PhD in Buddhism. You don't have to go and become a monk to do that deep study. It's possible to do a lot of intensive practice without being a monastic. Most of my colleagues, Vipassana teachers that I know, have done years and years of very intensive practice. And I would say that people in my circle of Vipassana teachers have done a lot more meditation practice and retreat practice than the average monk. The fact that someone is a monk in Theravada Buddhism does not even mean that they meditate. You know, we hold up monks as being kind of, there's a lot of projection onto monastics, idealization and projections at, you know, how they are. But if you go to Thailand, you certainly can find monks, not too difficult to find monks who have very deep practice, strong practice, practice a lot, and really use that form for that kind of purpose. There are other people who get ordained because they didn't quite make it in life. It was kind of, life was kind of hard. There was one lovely man who was the attendant to the abbot that I studied with when I was in Thailand. And I had the sense that he was there not really to practice, but he had been an alcoholic. And he was struggling with that, and that was his refuge. You know, he was free from alcohol, and it was, you know, he was using it as a refuge, as a place of safety, the monastic form. There's some people who, you know, you can go to, you can also see in Thailand, for example, monks who sit around smoking cigarettes and just chatting and watching television. And, you know, you find the whole range of things that go on. So the fact that someone is a monk doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, that they're following what we think should be their lifestyle and practice that they're doing. So the modern world has changed quite a bit, and so some of these modern teachers, lay teachers, have done a lot more practice than a lot of the people who, a lot of the average monk in Thailand, for example, and possibly a lot more than some of the people who are teaching. Monks who are teaching in Thailand already, because you can start teaching pretty quickly in Thailand once you're ordained. It's a common experience for people who get ordained as monks, Westerners, that the day after they're ordained as monks, they're asked to teach. You know, but they hardly practice. You know, it's like only a few months into it, and somehow they got ordained. So our life, because so life has changed a little bit, and so as life has changed in the modern world, and opportunities for practice have changed, does that change the role and the position and the of monastics? Added to the complexity of it all is that there is periodically in the history of Buddhism a certain kind of elitism that goes together with the monastics. Some monastics hold themselves as being special, and that they should be treated as kind of like with great honor, and everything should be taken care of for them, and you know they're special, and everyone who's lay people should really treat them as kind of royalty. And you kind of feel the sense of conceit and arrogance kind of sometimes from the monastics, and that they should be treated with royalty and be treated a certain kind of special way. Now, not all monastics hold themselves that way. Monastics are people like anybody else. To expect monastics to be enlightened the day they get ordained is to expect too much. So, and in some ways, I like to think of that people who come into a Buddhist community, whether it's a monastic community or IMC, there's a wide range of people who are here. But I think it's important to remember that perhaps a good percentage of the people who come are the people who really need to come. And they need to come because there's a lot of suffering. You know, there are difficulty in their life. And so, you know, and people who have a lot of difficulty and suffering are not necessarily people who are, you know, floating on a cloud in bliss and, you know, just very happy and peaceful. It's people who are struggling. And so, in monastic life as well, so you get to all kinds of range of people. And sometimes they get, they work through some of their egotism, and sometimes they don't. And sometimes the very form of monasticism reinforces a certain kind of conceit, because there is because separation, as you pointed out, separation from lay people, you know, they're separate. And once you're separate, you can consider yourself special, perhaps. And then there's a tremendous amount of reverence in countries like Thailand and Burma for them in Asia for monastics. And some of it is beautiful reverence. So I have a lot of reverence and respect for people who are living the monastic life, practicing that way. For a lot of them, but not all of them. I've met monks who I hung out with them, and remember there was one monk who came here to see me, to IMC. He came and met in the interview room, and he was so belligerent and so arrogant and so conceited that I basically ended the interview. You know, I was predisposed to be very respectful and reverent for him, but after a while it was clear, you know, this was a hopeless case. And I felt it was very unfortunate. And then I've had other monks who have listened to their teachings and just felt, there was one monk in particular, after I heard what he had to say, he gave a Dharma talk, I kind of had this feeling inside, wow, I've been in the presence of the Buddha. And when he got up to leave, I and everyone else in the hall stood up as well. You know, it's very rare in the West when someone, the Dharma teacher gets up, that people stand. You know, but everyone's, you know, so, it was so special. But, you know, it wasn't because he was a monk. It was because of the practice and the qualities and the wisdom that came through. So, can I go on? I'm going on for a long time. Is this okay? check in, because it's a difficult question. And so maybe could go on. Are you going to protest, or can I go on? If you don't know about it, I'd rather not. Oh, I can bring it up a little later, but let me finish this thread that I'm trying to, this thread that I'm trying to work out. perhaps the role and the position and the in Asia sometimes, and here in the West as well, sometimes there's this reverence to monastics. Sometimes it's well placed. And sometimes it's not well placed. Sometimes, and also some of that reverence that's given to the monastics, we put up on a pedestal, is sometimes a little odd. Because there is in traditional Buddhism an economy of merit that operates. And here in the West, we don't really relate so much to the idea of merit. But merits, and it's a little bit almost some of the ways that it operates in Asia, not always. Merit is also a profound concept. Maybe someday I'll give a talk on merit. But also, some of the ways this word merit is functions, it's kind of like earning brownie points. And you want to earn these points so that you can get some benefits. You can get reborn really well. So there are people have these merit passports sometimes. And they go around and do these different things in monasteries and make offerings and do gifts. And then the monastery stamps the passport. And they get full of these. And then when they get cremated, when they die, it's very important to get cremated with your merit passport. So somehow the, whoever, checks the passport, immigration. And so there's some very odd ideas, I think odd, and I'm going to be very careful. I don't want to be disrespectful for an institution that I have a lot of respect for, but I also don't want to give undue respect and to perpetuate a certain kind of imbalance that exists in this as well. So there's some odd things that happen and around merit. Oh, I remember in Thailand seeing poverty outside the walls of the monastery, tremendous poverty. And then seeing inside the monastery, gold. People coming and coming with gifts and money and this, because, you want, the idea is to make donations to where the merit is the highest, and the merit is highest if you give to the monks and to the monks who are most highly attained. And I would look outside the wall and look inside and say, well, the monks don't need it. And the people who need it are these people outside. But there's very little merit to giving to the poor. You get a lot of merit if you give to the monks. And I think that's really odd, really kind of a weird economy, weird idea. And so there's kind of this that people do, even monastics who don't want to be treated like royalty, which occasionally happens, is more often you have laity who treat the monastics as royalty. And so the monastic kind of treat them that way. And that also perpetuates, I think, kind of an unhealthy relationship. I think that there's no obligation in Buddhism to become a monastic. Becoming a monastic in and of itself does not make someone a spiritual person. The Buddha emphasized, and this was a talk I was going to give, so let me get back to this, and say briefly, that what's important is we should not identify, have it create an identity in the roles that we have. The identities the Buddha pointed to that we should take are the identities that come from how we are, the qualities that we act on. So when you're being generous, you're a generous person. When you're being kind, you're a kind person. And your identity is measured by your qualities like that, not by the roles that you have. And what's interesting about the qualities that you have is they only are there when they're there. If I was generous yesterday, and I could say, I'm a really generous person, that's not a really true statement. It means I was generous. Maybe I plan to be generous again. I'm generous when I'm being generous. And then poof, it goes away when you stop being generous. That's okay. If I look into myself, I'm happy. I see thoughts, feelings, motivations, things arise and pass. And I don't think of myself as those things. If anything, I think of myself as the space between all those things. What's not there, almost the freedom. That's the freedom between them, almost. So monastics, have it's a role. It's an important role for our society. In terms of one of the purposes, and I'm jumping around. I apologize. In Mahayana Buddhism, most of the highly attained archetypes, the bodhisattvas for the tradition, are lay people, except for one. And that's Kitishagarbha, Sanskrit name, or in Japanese they call it Jizo Bodhisattva. And Jizo is is depicted, that archetype is a monk. And he's the patron saint of children, babies, embryos, pregnant women, and for people who are most destitute, the most downtrodden, down and out people, the people who are living in hell. And when I saw that, I thought, is the people who are most down and out sometimes need to have a very powerful archetype to pull them out. And the monastic form is a very powerful archetypical form that really helps and supports people who are lost in their own personal hells. And I remember there was, I've known two people who were really down and out in really dramatic ways and strung out on drugs. And they saw a photograph of a great spiritual teacher. And just seeing that photograph was a turning point for them. There's something about seeing the archetype sometimes that can make a really big difference. It has a role for other people's lives. So I feel that there's no obligation for anybody to become monastic. And more interesting, there was absolutely no obligation whatsoever for lay people to offer any respect and any support for Buddhist monastics. Absolutely none. And it's not because of their monasticism, they're not spiritually better necessarily than other people. If they've practiced a long time, become wise and freer and more compassionate, then because of those qualities, then they deserve, not deserve, but then we might be inspired to support them. If they're a new monastic who doesn't develop all those qualities, maybe we can feel and see and sense in them the reason they've taken on that role, that institution of monasticism, is because their intention is to develop those things. And we say, great, I think I want to support those intentions. This is great. I'd like to help. I read this morning that Bhikkhu Bodhi every year gives a scholarship to a Thai nun who's one of these pioneers who's really kind of pushing the boundaries of the institution of nuns in Thailand, gives them a scholarship to go to university because he feels that if the nuns can get a college education in Buddhism, it's easier for them to get the kind of respect that they hope they'll get in a system that's often somewhat sexist. So the idea of supporting them, in many ways, so there's no obligation. There's no obligation to treat them in a special way. When they show up, monastic shows up in your life, you don't have to trip over yourself to figure out what's the right decorum and right way of treating them and should I be respectful. You don't have to do anything special. You don't do anything at all special to them at all. There's no obligation. Some of them might get annoyed with you because they have this conceit. I'm special, and I need to be treated kind of nicely and all that, and this is disrespectful and all that. But if, for example, you invite a person, a monastic or anybody, to teach you. Anybody you invite to teach, you should treat with respect. So if we invite a nun to come here to teach for us, those of us who come here regularly, I think it's, just a normal thing. It's a healthy, right thing to offer some respect to someone who's been invited. They didn't ask to come and teach. They didn't ask to have a benefit here. So, my delight to be able to offer them the support that we can. I have a lot of respect for these people, these nuns, a lot of respect for what they're trying to do. I think it's really wonderful what they're trying to do. I think it's hard what they're trying to do. There might be some things which I feel a little odd about them and about their institution and some of this little odd dynamics of, but aren't we all odd? Are we going to hold it against people who are trying their best, really sincere and dedicated? I hope not. People are, I'd rather kind of see that that we're all trying to find our way together, and we're friends and family, and we're trying to find a way forward and trying to find ourselves. And if there is kind of oddity or a little tension or little differences, that we can talk about it and work it out and find our way, rather than sort of close the doors and say, well, just because someone's a little odd. So like in this talk today, I'm odd. You know, I'm still trying to understand this whole issue. And I don't feel like I have understand the whole issues around monasticism, lay people, and what goes on and with nuns. And it's something that I'm still in process with understanding. And and I'm hoping to talk to the nuns and talk to other people and try to understand in a much better way. But I think it's important to understand that that any elitism or separation, there's a separation. But society often has separation. And it's a normal part of life to separate things. It can be healthy. When I was a monk in Japan, I loved being in an all-male monastery. I thought it was great. I thought all men should have this chance. And I think all women should have a chance to be in an all-women's community for a while and practice there. And I think it's really great and very important to practice co-ed altogether. All options are great. And you don't have to hold them apart from each other. Separation has its benefits. Separation can have its problems as well. And so we want to be able to understand the strengths and weaknesses of all the different things and use them as it's appropriate. Separation does cause problems. So how do we work with those problems, the elitism that can happen? I think one of the ways as lay people is to realize that as lay Buddhists, we are not, the monastics are not the popes. They are not the leaders of what is Buddhism and what Buddhists should do. We don't turn to them as being the arbitrators of what Buddhism is, because the Buddha himself did not want that. The Buddha, as he was dying, said, now that I'm dying, I am not going to appoint someone as the leader that you have to then adhere to. It's the Dharma and the ethics, the ethical guidelines, which are your teachers now. So we don't look towards the monastics as kind of the equivalent of kind of the ecclesiastical authority. We look for them for inspiration, for teachings. We look for them as someone perhaps that we're inspired by. And we look for them as someone perhaps that we want to support. Because I think one of the great things to do is not only practice yourself, but then to be able to feel the benefits of your own practice and wish it for other people as well, and offer that support. And it can be for lay people here at IMC. We all support each other here. It can be for monastics. It can be for all kinds of things. So, is that an okay answer? I'm happy to talk more, but it's 10. We're already running late now. And very briefly, what this controversy has to be about is that in Australia there was a monk who ordained four women as full nuns. The nuns who are coming here to IMC next week are not full nuns, because the tradition of ordaining full nuns died out, and there's a whole this legal question that monastics are struggling under, legal questions about whether we can't really do it anymore because it's no longer the legal requirements required for it, so you can't resurrect this thing. And a number of people around the globe now are beginning to relook at this and say, well, let's do it anyway, or we can actually do it, or they're reinterpreting the laws, the Buddhist rules. And so he ordained four nuns. But that created quite a bit of controversy, because he's part of a particular network of temples, of monasteries, where all the abbots operate cooperatively. And he didn't operate cooperatively. And so, the other people felt that he kind of then, so then they kicked him out of the association. Because the association is there to cooperate. And if he's not cooperating, then you know. So that, they felt excommunicated, and So it's, you know, and the story goes on and on. And it's very complicated, the whole issue of Buddhist nuns. And I don't quite understand all of it myself at this point, all it entails. But I do find it kind of ridiculous that there has to be these ancient rules of authority about who can and cannot be ordained. At least speaking for myself, if a group of women wanted to live the lifestyle of traditional Buddhist nuns and to practice that form and develop their wisdom, their freedom, their generosity, I'm prepared to offer them lots of respect as much as I would for someone who did it through official channels. I don't need to have official channels to respect someone living that lifestyle. And I think it's, you know, I think it's high time to see, for those people who want to have that lifestyle, to see it happen. But there's a lot of controversy in this whole area. And so I just kind of scratched the surface. And I'd rather just, I don't really want to be involved so much in the controversy. I would just like to offer respect and support for the people who follow a lifestyle that inspires me. Yes, Barbara.
Just another example of creating suffering. We're creating our own suffering by our own expectations and rules and traditions rather than just living as human beings.
Yeah.
It's just another, reminds me of so many traditional religions, right. which is why I'm here and not there.
I think it's sad when a great world religion is dedicated towards the alleviation of suffering, it itself causes more suffering. There's something that's not held just the right way then. So now we have tea. And the controversies continue over tea or not. And so I hope this was okay, and thank you all.